I wouldn't say we fell in love right away. I think we were, as they call it in the biz, trauma bonding.
And then after 8 years of being insufferably sober, I started drinking again.
Addicts tend to be rather sensitive people.
Aren't you Marc Maron? I'm like, yeah. And she goes, what happened to you?
Hi, you're listening to Recover Girl. It's a podcast all about addiction and recovery. I am your host, Anna David. You can find out more about this podcast by going to recovergirlpod.com. And I'm just going to get right into our guest because this is just two gal pals chatting.
Pretty much.
This is Mary Patterson Broom.
Hi.
She's a comedian. She's the editor-in-chief of rehabreviews.com/afterpartymagazine. She writes for Women's Health.
Correct.
She worked on a show on WeTV.
Yep.
I always forget the James Franco.
It was nominated for an Emmy. I'm just going to say that. Making a scene with James Franco on AOL.com.
That's amazing.
It was nominated for an Emmy for production, not
doesn't matter.
Writing, but I still say Emmy nominated.
Emmy nominated. Yeah.
Yes.
I'm sorry. I thought you were saying Sexbox was nominated for an Emmy.
No. And
I
almost Sexbox lost my mind. Was cut after four episodes.
Yeah. Yeah.
They didn't even air all the episodes of Sexbox.
Yeah. So MP, as she's known, she and I met when she started working for After Party Magazine. It all happened very organically.
Yep.
In fact, what happened is, so Danielle Stewart,
who's gotten me every job I've ever had in this town,
who moved away. I'm sure you've been seeing her, but it's like,
yeah, but I mean, she's coming back and forth some. I don't like to think of it that she moved away. I feel like she's at college and she's going to be coming home for summers and holidays.
It's kind of true and yet kind of not. So Danielle was literally my right hand at After Party. And she had to do everything. And at one point, I tasked her with having to do like thousands of rehab reviews. And she's like, well, I just asked some of my friends to do them is what happened. And I'm like, she shows it to me. And I go, this one's really good.
Then and it was mine?
Yes. Then she secretly gets you in as quote unquote Sarah.
Oh, that's right. Before I was comfortable writing about getting sober, I went under a pseudonym.
Yeah.
To talk about. Wait, I did that as talking to a newcomer, correct? That was the Sarah thing? Yes. Or was it how I got sober?
No, it was Danielle was pitched me a story. She goes, why don't I do a thing where I interview a friend who's getting sober at 45 days, at 60 days, and at 90 days? And so that was quote unquote Sarah. So I got to know your story. And then one day, I forget, she just sort of brings you in. We needed more writers. And she goes,
well, let's not forget you wanted my parking pass.
I wanted your parking pass. But I didn't know if that was the first meeting.
That was the first meeting.
Hilarious.
To talk about the parking pass, because I had a coveted parking pass on El Cerrito Place by WeWork. And it was that. And then talking about doing the admin freelance? This is riveting information, this background story. But
So all I know is that we were sitting in my little office and suddenly you were coming in every day and then suddenly you were running the show and now you literally run the show and
thank
I'm gone.
Thank you. I owe so much to Anna David. I can't even.
Are you thanking me every day though on
it's
the days?
It's a pretty sweet gig.
Okay,
like,
right
I'm
now.
Actually
yes, good,
happy.
Good, good. I'm
I mean,
so glad.
I don't necessarily know that I'll always want to deal with this particular content.
Yes.
But I like the work and the nature of the work, the mix of writing and editing, and I get to use my creative side and my organized side. I was trying to do stand-up comedy full-time when I met Anna, and I needed extra money because I was not making enough money doing that. And it slowly started to build getting the money from After Party and Rehab Reviews. So it's kind of turned into that's more full-time and stand-up's more part-time.
Right.
Which I'm fine with. That kind of thing used to like devastate me. I was so dramatic about it. But
right.
Like, you know, you don't know. Life doesn't always turn out the way you picture it, but that's not necessarily a bad thing.
Absolutely. And, you know, my favorite quote that I'm obsessed with now is this David Hawkins quote, we get what we want when we stop insisting on it.
Oh, that's good.
Which is really another way of saying surrender. So it's like when you start paying, you know, the universe doesn't know the need, but don't know the difference between a sort of fear and a desire.
Yes.
So when we really want these, especially these creative dreams, we put all this fear onto it. And I truly believe it keeps those dreams from becoming a reality. Whereas then when we focus on, okay, here I am doing my rehab reviews, then like, mm-hmm. you know, then this other stuff starts popping up, I believe.
Well, I also think that when I look back at when I was working at an agency for comedians, seeing all these headlining comedians travel and do stand-up and get paid. And I wanted so desperately for that to be me already. And I quit that place and was like, I got a bunch of road gigs because I had all these contacts. And I was like, that's it. I'm a full-time comic. But I didn't really, and this was classic, like, untreated alcoholism mm-hmm. because I had such instant gratification issues mm-hmm. and I didn't even research like, what's your budget? How much money do you need to bring in a month? Like, are right. you going to be able to, what if you don't book anything after the next 2 months, you
right,
know?
Right, right, right.
And so I think that I've learned, I'm really glad that I did that, that I took the leap of faith and pursued it full time because I sort of learned how important it is for me to have my bills paid in order to be sane.
Yep.
So as much as I admire people that can do a bunch of different jobs in order to pursue their art, I am more comfortable with sort of a direct deposit every other week situation.
I hear you.
Through all that, I had to learn that, you know?
Yeah, yeah.
And I'm still obviously able to do the creative things I want to do, but I sleep at night because I know my rent's paid.
Yeah, yeah. And I mean, what's interesting to me too about your story is it's kind of like we were just talking about Paul, who, you know, worked at After Party and a previous podcast guest. Who, what was the connection to Paul? Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah. How really, you know, he had not done this kind of writing and suddenly this is something he's doing. This was new. I mean, you'd always been a writer.
Correct. But you very much encouraged the writing because remember when I wrote that first news story and you were like, this is good. And then I started like cranking those out and right. I got comfortable doing the essays and
right.
yeah, it was a confidence boost. I'm glad that I learned that I could do that.
Yeah, and I'm not just like blowing smoke because you're sitting on my couch, but the fact that I mean you were the ideal employee because you could write fast, and you're completely obsessive about all administrative stuff, and that's all really someone could want at a publication. It's true,
you know. That's where I feel like people pleasing comes in good. You yeah. are a good employee. Like I'll say yeah. that about myself. Like I struggle with negative self-talk a lot, but I know I'm a good employee yeah. and a good worker, and I will always stand by that. Like,
do you remember that thank you note your mother wrote me? It was so sweet.
For what? I mean, okay. She loves a thank you note.
She loves a thank you note.
She loves a
thank
you note.
To the point that she was thanking me for a thank you note. She was either thanking me for my thank you note or she was thanking me for coming to brunch.
My sister and I have a song we made up called Thank You for the Thank You Note based on my mother and her friends with their back and forth thank you noting. So she thanked you for coming to brunch and for hiring me?
What she did is I think that we went to brunch. I think I wrote her a thank you note and I think she wrote me a response and I just never forget that she wrote, and thank you for appreciating Mary Patterson's work ethic.
Oh, yeah.
Nobody so works sweet. Harder yes. and I'm glad you see that.
You know, my mom told me she was proud of me when I was home last week.
Aww.
And it really helped because I've always been fearful that she's not because yeah. I'm not married and don't have a husband and like children and I right. know that's important to her. And that's something I want anyways, but you know, there's always been this fear I have that she didn't think I turned out well. Mm. And she went on about how proud she was and how I was brave and talented and went Aww. For everything. And she goes, I just want you to be happy. And she's like, my concern is always that you're not as happy as I'd like you to be. And I'm like, that is so satisfying just to hear that.
Yeah.
Why does it feel so good to have your parents tell you they're proud of you? Does everybody get obsessed with that?
I don't know. I mean, let's call it possibly an alcoholic thing where, you know, that seeking validation and that, you know, that negative self-talk of I'm never enough. And, you know, what I'm kind of thinking a lot about lately is this thing that Dr. Drew told me about the dandelion and orchid theory, which is that some people are dandelions and they grow up very resilient and you can say whatever you want to them and nothing's going to upset them. And then there are these orchids. And so what may not register as trauma to a dandelion does to an orchid because like, I'm just going to speak for myself, like this super sensitive creature. So, you know, one day mom being or dad being disappointed in a grade registered as like traumatic to mm-hmm, me and began this talk of like, oh, you're stupid.
Right,
whereas
right.
like a dandelion would have been like, yeah, whatever, dad, I'll get the next
yeah,
one.
Yeah, that's really good. I, you know, and I think my parents always say like, you were just ambitious. You're the one that wanted to go to a good college. And I'm like, yeah, but achieving has always felt like, oddly enough, I compared myself more to my father than my mother, and he right. was always about achieving.
Yeah.
And even when I would get, like, a really good gig, and I love my dad. I have a great dad. I'm not dogging him. But, like, as recently as I remember, one of the best gigs I've ever done was opening for Maria Bamford
yeah.
in a sold-out theater in Birmingham, Alabama, which is not my hometown but my home state. And it went so well, and it was one of the best shows I've ever had. And I called my dad afterwards, and I'm like, it went great. And his first question was, well, what did the headliner think?
Right.
Do you think you'll work with her again? It's always right. like, what's next? And I'm like, no wonder. I never know. Feel like I'm enough. Like, I love him.
Right.
But, like, you know what I'm saying?
I do. And it's like, I wonder if it's, you know, having kids. Hold on, water break.
I should have clarified my water break earlier.
How dare you? I thought you were a pro. You know, that thing where I wonder if it's sort of like the, not codependence, but, you know, a child's desire is so, a parent's desire is so tied in with the child's that they sort of ask the question that like, that we ask too.
Yeah.
Which is rather than taking a lot of, you know, I'm sure other parents are different, rather than taking the pause and going, oh my God, that is so great for you.
Right, right.
I remember my first book, Party Girl, this really
great book. I read it. Highly recommend.
Thank you, thank you. There's this writer named, not Jennifer Weiner.
Not her.
Jennifer, I'm blanking on her name. She's super successful of the Jennifer Weiner category. And I can't believe it because she's a friend of mine.
She is up there.
She's like close to there.
She's a Jennifer. That's her first name?
Yeah. And I'm just completely blanking and I'm embarrassed. But anyway, she was a fan of mine. We had a mutual friend and she really loved Party Girl and she really championed it. And she's a very big writer. She's the one, oh God.
Is it the one about New Black? Like she's in Chicago.
Yeah, exactly.
And she goes bankrupt or loses.
Who is that?
The .com.
Exactly. She's got about 10 books. She's amazing. So she was a big champion of mine to the point that when she was asked to sort of headline the Chicago Literary Festival, she had me open for her or whatever, whatever the equivalent is. And my dad's college roommate lives in Chicago and came to it. And all my dad told me about it was like, so I heard you were just there as like a warm up.
Oh my God.
Like here I was appearing at the Chicago like literary festival. It was like a highlight. And she was so cool that she was championing me throughout her whole thing. I'm like, Shulkin. No, that's not her. No, that was my editor. She's an amazing woman. I cannot believe it. Anyway, it's killing me. But anyway.
We don't have our phones out. Otherwise, we Google it. We're trying to be in the moment.
We are in the moment. Look at us.
No phone.
So this idea that you found, quote, your voice as a writer in recovery. And this was unplanned. This was because you were looking for a day job, really.
Yeah. I mean, because remember, I was really scared to write about it at first.
I do.
And I think it's because of where I'm from. There's just a lot of, it's still kind of Southern old school. Like you don't talk about your business. And I think, you know, in some ways I haven't been I don't reveal every freaking detail that happened when I was still drinking that led me to quit drinking. But I've tried to be open in a way that's comfortable with me. And I feel like it does pour out of me. I don't know if it's because I love talking about myself or like what, but, yeah, it has become something that comes out of me easily. Like, you know, you recently had me do something for your new project about sober dating. And I cranked it out so easily.
It is so good. Yeah.
And so I think when the writing comes easy like that, it feels like it's right.
Yeah. I was just thinking of the sober. It's funny because the sober dating, I do remember your sort of struggle to, I don't know if I want to write about this. I'm not comfortable as.
And by the way, I still have moments where I'm like, shit, what have I put on the internet, you know? Yeah, and I freak out and I go, you know what, Mary Patterson, you have to accept that's who you are.
Yeah.
And you're a creative person and people appreciate vulnerability and honesty with artists. And like, if you don't want to do it anymore, then stop doing it.
Yeah.
And like what's there is there. But I definitely still have freak out moments about it. But go ahead.
I do too.
Okay.
I do too.
Okay. Okay.
Yeah,
that makes me feel better because I feel like you're so brave forward with it, like open
here is something that I do tell people that I coach with writing is, I didn't think about it at all. And there are things I regret putting out. I'm so much more careful now about what I will and won't reveal what is mine and what is the world.
Exactly.
And that's something that I think it's important to get really clear on before you start doing it.
Mm-hmm.
It's interesting too, because so we do this storytelling show called Hammer Time. It's every other month in LA. And the last one was Facebook Live. If that's a word.
Mm-hmm.
And I talked about things in that, you know, and I specifically said the word fuck over and over again, which I don't.
Mm-hmm.
And I just thought of it as staying in the room. And then a lot of people saw it and I felt a little uncomfortable with that.
Yeah. Well, I mean, remember I told him before, don't record me because I was going to be naming names.
Oh, I didn't know that. But then did you change it?
No, I just said to Ryan, I said, please don't.
Mine. You're not in it?
I don't think so.
Oh,
no.
Interesting.
I mean, because I was specifically talking about an incident with, you know, friends of my parents, and I didn't want them to be. I just like on the off chance because I'm friends with their daughter on Facebook. You just never know. I just didn't want them to hear. You know, like sometimes that room feels like that's the kind of stuff. There's been a few stories I've shared in there that I would not share in an article
online
that's going to be out there for forever.
Yeah, that's. I'm sorry. That story was so freaking funny, but I do remember that there is a very specific family. Sorry, listener, that you can't know what it is. So I'm curious about that transition from discomfort to, okay, I'm going to write about it. And do you get healing / comfort from sharing those stories?
You know, honestly, I feel like at the beginning it was just for the money.
Yeah.
And that's all I was thinking about.
I was basically prostituting you.
When I first started writing, I just needed money so badly. I was so broke.
You're like $50 a story.
In 2015, it was bad. Or 2014, 2015, whenever I was just not doing well financially at all. So I thought more about the money. You know, is it healing? I guess when it's complete and I'm like done, sent off, like any creative project, it does feel healing.
Mm-hmm.
But in a lot of ways, I have so much resistance with writing that I look at it sometimes more as a burden, but I've just accepted the fact that I never feel like doing anything.
Right.
And that's my new motto with stand-up, with writing, anything creative that involves me using brain power and being uncomfortable, as you would say, I don't feel like doing it.
Right.
And so it's hard for me to say that it's healing because I feel like there's people out there that blog every day and they just love doing it. It's healing to them. For me, I'm like, I know I have an article to write and I think about it and I obsess about it. And I'm like, why did I take this? You know? And then when I actually do it and like face my resistance and my discomfort and it's done, I feel amazing, but that doesn't last that long.
Yeah.
So it's one of those things where like, I want to be doing the creative work because I know it pushes me beyond, you know, sort of what my job entails now, which is kind of mindless in a lot of ways,
mm-hmm.
but I still have so much resistance around it. I mean, I've got, you know, a web series that's been written for a year mm-hmm. that I can't bring myself to make because of all the fears I have around it and the discomfort with having to figure out the things that are unknown.
You mean in terms of like basic, like
in
how
terms
do you put
of
it
like,
out?
I gotta find a DP. I gotta find somebody to edit it. Like, how am I going to schedule these locations? All those things, which are just part of the creative process. When you make something like that, I let those things sort of keep me in a position of fear. At least with writing, it's like all I got to do is sit down and do it.
Right.
But I still have a lot of resistance around it and a lot of fear and a lot of like, there's no way I'm going to be able to do this. Like, I can't. And then I sit down and I do it and it's always done. So, but even with stand-up shows, like me and a few of my friends always joke, like, we dread every show we book.
Yeah.
But I'm always glad I did it.
Yeah.
And I've just accepted, like, when I say to myself, oh, I don't feel like doing the show. I'm like, yep, you're never going to feel like it.
Right.
You're never going to feel like it.
Right.
Because
I
always want to be comfortable and doing stand-up is uncomfortable. That went on a tangent.
No,
from
that's
the question
a perfect
about
tangent. But what's interesting
writing.
To me is I know many people. No, I would say I have two people in my life who I know very well who are extremely resistant to putting themselves out there, and I watch the struggle.
Mm-hmm.
And you put stuff out constantly. Again, I'm in a situation where I have to. Oh Jesus Christ! I just spilled water on myself. Where I see what you're putting out because a lot of the time it's stuff I've assigned to you.
Right. Right.
So it's surprising to me to hear that that's your struggle.
Right.
Because you do it. The people that I'm thinking of, they don't do it.
Yeah. Yeah.
They literally do the work and don't put it out there.
Well, sometimes with my stand-up, especially because I just always end up writing about myself and my life because I find with observational comedy now, there's so many people doing it. It's like, it's so hard to be unique.
Right.
But sometimes I feel like I get off stage and I'm like, you just bared your soul. Like, you should have said that in therapy. And like, and if I got laughs and I'm just, but so I still struggle with that balance of like, I think it makes you a unique comic when you get up there and people know a little bit more about who you are as a person when you get off stage.
Yeah.
But in some ways, it's really scary when you're up there talking about how you ate your feelings because you had to quit drinking or, you know.
Right.
The latest guy broke up with you and he had a room, like stuff like that. You know, like it's all just that artist's life of being vulnerable. So I appreciate you feeling, you saying that you think I put myself out there because I constantly feel like I don't enough and that's why I'm not more successful or whatever.
Do you, I will tell you, there's no right or wrong answer, truly. Like with our show, it is the one performance thing that I don't dread. I did for the first year or two. And now I'm at the point where I'm shocked the day of the show. I'm super excited about
yeah.
it. Then I'm super happy. I'm very conscious when on stage that I'm really enjoying myself.
Yeah.
And then I finish and I'm like, God, I did well.
I know. It's so funny with that show. I don't dread that show, but I do have fear every single time that it's not going to go well and it's going to be dead silence. I don't have that with stand-up because for the most part, I haven't luckily I started with stand-up not bombing a lot, so I've always had like a false sense of like it's gonna be fine. I mean, I could always bomb, and
but
I definitely
never bombed at our show.
Well, that's but it's a different art form, so I just still feel like it feels new.
Right.
But I do feel like I've gotten more comfortable with it, but I am always fearful that it's not gonna go well. But that seems to work for me because it goes well.
It goes
so maybe
well
I should
every
just keep
time.
Having that fear every
well,
time.
That goes also back to every story that you turn in and go, this is the worst thing I've ever written.
It's always like, I love it.
It's always my favorite.
It's so weird how that always happens.
Always.
Every time I fire it off and I'm like, I mean, hopefully she'll find a nice way to tell me this is garbage, but, you know, it's going to be a rewrite, but I just can't look at it anymore. And you're always like, I love it. It's the best thing you've ever written.
But, and also, you know how honest I am.
Oh,
that
I know
I am
you're honest.
Not
yeah.
just saying that.
No, I know you're not just
like,
saying that.
Like, it's a because yeah. I have no problem being like, you know what, this is, no.
I know you don't.
Rewrite this.
I know you don't.
But it's interesting. So, which leads me to believe, especially given what you're saying about the resistance and that and then this isn't unusual for an alcoholic. Your perception of it is just completely 180 degrees off.
I have a warped perception of a lot of things. Yes.
Yeah, but especially around this.
Yes, around this being the writing.
Being the writing.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's interesting to me. So, and also, here is my theory too, that this is healing this kind of thing, this kind of writing about, you know, your, you know, are things we should be most ashamed of or whatever, is healing in ways that you don't write it, put it out there and be like, I'm healed.
Well, you know, another thing that I should point out is when I first started to feel like I wanted to quit drinking and I started to have that voice deep inside that was like, you're not really doing this normally, or this is causing pain, more pain than good. I started to read blogs.
Yeah.
I was one of those. Before I ever stepped foot into a meeting or told a friend I was struggling, I started to read about it.
Yeah.
I read Stephanie Wilder Taylor's blog,
yep.
Crying Out Now, and I listened to the Bubble Hour podcast. But reading about it, I've always been a reader, and so it really helped me.
Right.
And I think in a way, I do feel good. I had someone reach out to me from my past. I might have told you this already, but your listeners can hear. On Facebook, who I hadn't even seen or thought about since college. And she said, your articles have helped me so much. I've wow. decided to be sober this January. Like, you know, I really appreciate it. And I'm like, okay, well, I helped one person in the same way that somebody helped me. So like,
have you really only heard from one person
in terms of like
recovery?
This helped
stuff?
Me with.
There are.
Yeah, I mean, okay. that I can think of off the top of my
now,
head.
Now, but let me ask you something else. All those blog posts you wrote, how many people did you email to say, God, this really helped me?
Very good question. I commented when Stephanie Wilder Taylor recently posted her sobriety date on Facebook. I commented and said, reading your stuff helped me.
Right.
And then the woman who wrote Understanding the High Functioning Alcoholic.
Oh, yes, Sarah Benton.
Yeah, I reached out to her.
Right. Well, and then you wrote about her for
I wrote
after
about
party.
Her. So
right.
I guess, was that why I reached out to her?
I think so, yeah.
Okay. So I was getting paid to reach out to her.
Yeah.
But either way, you're right. You're right. There could be people out there that, I forgot. I thought of one more guy.
Yeah.
I thought of another comedian who I ran into at a show and he told me he hadn't drank and he said he read my thing about the fitness challenge I did.
Oh, yeah.
Or the
yeah.
one I wrote about how I look better now than I did in my 20s because I'm sober.
Yeah.
And he was like, that was so good. It really helped me. Okay. That's the second person.
Well, and
I've helped two people, yes.
But no, and so that's my point, is for every person who actually bothers to reach out, how many hundreds of people are there out there that are reading it and...
Yes, hopefully.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know. I know that to be true. I can't imagine the number of things I have read that have helped me. And I personally, selfishly, don't think I've ever reached out to any of them.
Right, right.
Ever.
No, that's a good way to... I hadn't thought about that. I also kind of, I feel like I haven't been as strong with promoting the stuff I've written about recovery.
Right.
I'm like, I'm going to put it out there, but I'm not going to like really push for it.
Right.
Because that's still that fear of like,
yeah,
what are people going to think? What are people going to assume? You know, all that stuff. So I still have a little bit of that, which I've already said. So it's not like, you know, that's news, but
I have the same thing.
Yeah.
Because it's sort of like I have this fear that people are like, Jesus Christ, this girl, and talking about her recovery enough already. Like, we get it. You're sober. You're into it. And
but you've made a career out of it.
Well,
so,
and people who become, you know, like friends will be like, God, I thought you were way more into this than you actually are.
Because of, yeah, exactly.
Like, of course I'm into it, but
right.
it's hardly my whole life and thing I talk about in my free time.
Right, right.
What was I going to say? Well, I was going to say, okay, this in the coaching program. So I have this coaching program for writers where I take 10 people at a time through the process of sort of, this is how you write essays, this is how you get them published, this is how you sort of create an online persona, and ultimately, this is how you write a book proposal and sell it, and then one out of every 10 gets a meeting with a lit agent and publisher.
Mm-hmm.
Perhaps unsurprisingly, 5 of the 10 people in my current program are sober people writing memoirs about their addiction.
Right, right.
And I would say 3, I can't exactly remember, 3 out of those 5 started going, I'm going to write under a pseudonym. I'm not comfortable writing about this. I'm not comfortable writing about that. And all of them ended up changing their mind.
Really?
Yeah. And they're all doing it.
Well, you know what? Can I talk about our the coaching sessions we're going to do at Breathe?
Oh, yeah. Yeah. I forgot to tell you. No. It's, first of all, it's at Casa Capri.
Oh, Casa Capri. Okay.
And it's totally final.
Okay. Yeah. Oh, we're doing that.
We're doing that. Yeah,
so Anne and I are going to go help people write their stories that are in treatment currently, correct?
Exactly. And then perform them.
So Anna sent me the per pitch for, you know, what we're going to, what's the course is going to be like.
Yeah.
you're doing it four times.
I'm coming on Saturday twice.
But in that you said, you basically broke down a little bit of what you teach, which is the importance of being specific in writing.
Yeah.
And people aren't specific because they're afraid to put what's really out there.
Yep.
And I was like, God, she's so right.
Yeah.
How did you come up with that? When did you realize that? Now I'm interviewing you.
No, I like this. Well, here's the thing is, you know how I feel about cliches, right?
Mm-hmm.
Which is that I go crazy when I see them. And I don't think anybody wants to use cliches. I think they use them because they're being lazy or fearful.
Mm-hmm. I think that's true.
And they think it sounds good. Like they come up with this turn of phrase and they're like, that's exactly how I feel. And boy, this sounds good. When actually what sounds good is their specific story.
Yes.
And, you know, my favorite thing that anyone will ever say to me about something I've written, I think you said it to me, I'm not sure, is I felt like I was hanging out with you.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's the greatest compliment I can get. And so you get that compliment because you're being specific about your story.
Yes. Yes. So true.
And
that's really good writing advice.
Well, and it's like, and if you think of our storytelling show, the things that make us laugh are these very specific things. And so, you know, I'll always tell people my story is not particularly interesting. I do not have an interesting addiction story. And yet I have made it into material that I've been paid for the past over a decade.
Right, right.
So clearly it doesn't have to do with how interesting your story is. It has to do with how you present it and tell it.
Yeah.
And like, you're going to be the best person at telling your story. So forget being like, I'm not as good a writer as this person or as that person because you're the best person at being you.
Right, right.
So I don't know. So I think that's how I realized that specific mattered. And just also years of editing people's essays is the people that I use again and again are the people that are specific.
Yeah. Very true.
So, and I do think it's fear. I think that people have so much fear around writing.
Oh, we're all just dripping in fear.
Well, we have some fear about everything.
Oh my God.
Just dripping in it. It's so true.
No, I mean, I feel like I've gotten better, but God, I look back at my life and I'm like, God, you've had so much fear about stuff of it. And I didn't even know that's what it was.
I know.
I mean, I'm not, you know, whatever. It's like I'm 33. It's like, why would I have known, you know, like when I was 25 that I was encapsulated by fear. But, you know, now I can look back and see so much of my issues were fear around so many things.
Yeah. Yeah, that's interesting. I mean, my fear, I don't feel like ever manifests itself as fear because I'm like, I can go on live TV. I can jump out of an airplane. But I'm terrified of my feelings.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
That's what it is.
Yeah.
You know, if I wake up and I don't feel completely right, I will go into a fear spiral about it's never going to end.
Yeah, I feel like that's gotten better for me.
Yeah, me too.
But I absolutely, used to have that same thing where I felt like if I felt bad, I'm going to feel bad forever and I'm fucked. You know what
I'm
saying?
And that's fear.
That's exactly.
So what advice would you give people for getting out of their own fear?
I would say don't expect yourself to not have it.
Yeah.
So acknowledge that it's there. And it's really helped me to sort of label the voice that talks the fear to me, that says things like, you know, you're never going to make more money than this. You're never going to meet a life partner, stuff like that. And say, on good days, I try to label that and go, okay, negative Nancy, like, thank you for your input. I'm doing the best I can.
Right.
And so I just try to, for me, it's been accepting that the fear is not going to go away. It's how you respond to it.
Right.
And what you believe to be true versus what your thoughts are telling you is true.
Right.
So, you know, knowing you are not your mind and you are not your thoughts. And just because you have a thought doesn't mean it's true. And this is all stuff that's been given to me. So I'm not, you know, reinventing the wheel here, but that's, this stuff has just been profound for me to learn over the past few years. That whatever I create in my mind is not necessarily reality. Yeah. It's not reality.
Yeah.
Most of the time it's not. And I can be in a great mood one day, have the exact same circumstances the next day and feel like everything is shit.
Yeah.
And I am fucked and all that. And it's like, wow, that's like, just acknowledging that has helped me and been like, you know, knowing that I'm not always going to feel that way because just yesterday I felt great.
Yeah.
You know?
I know. Do you, and I mean, that the way that will contribute to addiction and relapse, I mean, people who, you know, especially people with long-term sobriety or whatever, who think that the way they feel is how they're always going to feel. And so they go out or whatever it is.
Right.
Now, just about your story, how long are you sober? I can't remember.
It was 3 years, March 30th.
Okay.
So.
And was there
3 years and a few months?
Was there an actual quote unquote thing that got you sober?
I always say that my things, plural, happened over the course of 2013. There was multiple instances where I can look back and remember. I remember feeling at the time like I gotta stop drinking, or I know I can't keep drinking, or I'm gonna take this to my grave. And so all of those collectively, I mean, there was one event in particular that I don't want to share on the podcast because I'd like to keep that for me. That happened in 2013 that I consider like my worst bottom. And I always think back to that. And that was one of those things where I was like, I'm going to take it to my grave. And then my grave kept getting heavier and heavier.
Right.
And so, you know, I think it was just, I'd say if I had to pinpoint one thing that I feel comfortable sharing. So 2013, there was just a lot of times where I overdrank when I said I wasn't going to, and I behaved in ways I wouldn't have behaved, or things happened that I would never have happened sober that create a lot of shame for me. And then Thanksgiving of 2013 is when I got really drunk at a friend's parents' house on the actual day, and one of my best friends drove me home, and 2 days later we spoke, and he said, you know, I feel like sometimes lately when you drink, a switch goes off and you become somebody different. He wasn't even rude about it. He wasn't like, we've all been talking about it. He was very nonchalant and casual. And he was like, and I was like, oh, no, I didn't mean to be the only one there that was incoherent drunk. And he said, why don't you just try having one or two? And I just burst into tears because I was like, I've tried that. Mm. Like multiple times I've tried that. And the fact that like, that's the suggestion being made to me. And I know I've already tried that 1,000 times. It was like such an epiphany of like, okay, you can't seem to do this in moderation. So,
and then it was about six months later.
So that was a turning point, and I stopped drinking after Thanksgiving, and you know my whole cruise ship story, and I had 72 days, and then I went on the cruise ship and started drinking again on the cruise ship. So that's when I started going to meetings and started like admitting like maybe I can't do this at all. And then for Anna's listeners, I had a stand-up comedy gig on a cruise ship for a month.
Mm-hmm.
It was 14 shows a week. They weren't going well. They didn't like me, like the corporate people. They'd seen my tape, but they still didn't like me. And I was so stressed out. And it was really, I didn't really have a lot of, quote, recovery in me at the time. I had dabbled in meetings, but hadn't really done any real work or gotten a sponsor or anything like that. And I was so miserable. And I remember thinking, I wrote in a journal. I have a journal of all this. You know, there's no way that the way I feel now, it could be worse if I drank. I got to escape this feeling. So I've got to drink.
Right.
And almost immediately, all the reasons why I'd quit resurfaced. The anxiety, the waking up, not knowing how I...
You got home because you were on a
back
ship.
To my cabin in the cruise ship.
Yeah.
You know, all that being really sick with hangovers and just having a lot of anxiety. And so that was another turning point, I think, sort of having 72 days without it, then going back and immediately having issues again. So it sort of proved to me like, oh, I can't really do this in moderation. So I probably can't do it ever. So it was after I got back from that, I drank for a few more weeks and nothing really dramatic happened in that period. But, the last time I drank ended with a really, really bad hangover. And I was in Atlanta trying to visit friends and manage a hangover. And I was like, I can't do this anymore. I just can't. I'm sick all the time. And I came back and I've been sober for since then.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And what do you think was different that time?
I don't know. I feel like this is where the God spiritual thing comes in. I really don't know. I remember I was in Atlanta in my friend's apartment and I woke up. It was like the second day of feeling hungover. And I was just like, I got on my hands and knees and I was like, God, please help me. I'm so sick of being sick all the time. And I don't know. I mean, you know, like believe what you want to believe about all that stuff, but I don't know why it was different.
Mm-hmm.
I really don't. But
in terms of the spiritual component, you grew up kind of religious.
Mm-hmm.
And let's just say, so you grew up in Alabama, we hinted at that.
Yes.
And, you know, and we're real, you were real religious for a while.
I was real into it. I was. Youth group, church camp.
Yeah.
All that. I like was in this partnership for youth. I hung out with the cool kids, but I did not drink in high school.
Yeah.
Because I was part of all this. I was a part of the Episcopal Diocese on Youth Commission. I can't remember the name of it now. But we did a lot of retreats and I thought it was hypocritical to drink underage.
Right.
But all my friends drank and they were like, why don't you drink? And I would hang out with them and I would smoke cigarettes, but I wouldn't drink. I didn't start drinking until I was 17.
Mm-hmm.
And I also wanted to get into a really good college. So I was obsessed with extracurricular activities and filling my resume and making good grades and all that.
Mm-hmm.
So I feel like once I got in, I sort of decided I could relax.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's when I started drinking. And then the Christian thing, I wasn't as into in college. And that kind of faded out. So I consider myself now more spiritual.
Yeah.
Christian.
We like the S word over the R word.
Yes.
Yeah. And do you, what do you say to people who are like, yeah, I would love to get sober, I would love to do meaning, whatever, but I'm not into God?
I would say that don't even use the word God. Think of it as your greatest good.
Mm.
The flow of your life that's out of your control. So we all know. In our life, there's so many things we can't control. We might try to control all of it, but we can't. So I like to think of God sometimes as the things that are working for me, whatever thing you want, the universe, my life force that I can't see or control. So, you know, I think that word God and however you associate it with traditional religion, maybe remove that from it and think of it as the forces beyond your control.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know... I don't know. There's so much more to, if you're talking about 12-step in particular, than just like, oh, pray it away, ask God. I mean, there's so much more to it. So I guess I think mm-hmm. about that component of it, but I think there's so much more
mm-hmm.
that if you don't even want to think about the God thing at first, think about the just talking to somebody else that's been through what you've been through.
Yeah.
And the idea of being of service. And so you're out of your head, not thinking about yourself and you're staying busy. I mean, if the God thing's holding you back, think about the other parts of.
Yeah.
Not that that's the only way to get sober or quit drinking and, you know. All of that, but yeah, on days when I think, life force.
And how would you say that we'll work towards wrapping up, I promise.
Oh, that's okay.
How would you say your life has improved since you've been sober? You look better. We know you wrote about that. Yeah. And that really affected some guy.
I do look better. Yeah. I do feel like my body was never meant to handle alcohol. And this is before I ever even started to think, I just felt like the minute I started drinking, I started struggling more with weight and skin and discomfort, bloating, all that stuff. So just on a sheer like physiological level, I don't think my body tolerates alcohol mm-hmm. well. And I don't think it ever did. So my day-to-day just being comfortable in my own skin has improved 1,000%. Even on days when I feel, quote, fat or I've gained some weight or I've been, you know, eating my way through Alabama like I was the past 2 weeks. It's still never been the bloat that I dealt with when I was drinking. So there's that. That sounds really shallow, but that makes a huge difference in just your day-to-day comfort. I don't know. Life is just much more manageable. I'm not taken out by being hungover every other week or, you know, because I was never a daily drinker. I was more of a binge drinker, but, you know, that was occurring more and more frequently at various periods of my life. So I feel like I'm not sick as often. I feel like I was voluntarily making myself sick on a regular basis. So just because I'm not sick all the time, I'm more productive.
Right.
I sleep way better. I feel like I'm much more equipped to be in a relationship because I love myself more because I can go to bed every night remembering everything I said that day. Mm-hmm. Sometimes I still regret what I said,
mm-hmm.
of course, but I don't wake up and go, how did I get home? What did I say? I don't have to deal with any of that.
Mm-hmm.
Like I always say, like the committee in my brain that used to be dedicated to nursing a hangover or thinking about drinking or obsessing about, am I drinking too much or do I need to quit drinking? They've all been laid off. And so that department opened up for other things.
I love that.
And so it's just like, you know, all of that. So it's like life is different and it's not always, there's definitely moments where I, you know, it's so hard and I wish I wasn't. But for the most part, I'd say the way I look at it is it's 23 hours of serenity and the occasional like 1 hour of discomfort if you're somewhere that you would normally be having a cocktail or a drink.
Right.
So it's sort of experiencing everything at a more steady level as opposed to the extreme ups and downs.
Yeah. God, very well said.
Thank you.
And quite positive.
Okay, good.
I like it. So Mary Patterson Broom, she's got, you can find out more about MP on her website, which is
uppermiddleclassangst.com or marypattersonbroom.com. And I'm doing stand-up. I'm doing a comedy festival in North Carolina in August.
Okay.
In which Asheville.
This will post before that.
So it will. Good. And a comedy festival in Flagstaff, Arizona.
Nice.
In September.
So if you live there or you want to travel there and you want those states.
You have people all over the country listening, right?
I'm sorry.
I want to get some new fans out of this.
International.
I mean, I wasn't very funny, but you know, I promise on stage I'll be funnier.
You can't help but be funny. So, but and then you're on all the social medias.
Oh, yeah. At Mary Patterson B on Instagram and Twitter.
Mm-hmm.
I don't really like Facebook, but you can add me on Facebook if you want.
Yeah. So you can find her there. You can find out more about this podcast by going to recovergirlpod.com. And if you are interested in my coaching program, I have to say, when you post this, I'm getting ready. I'm doing a new group in the fall. You do have to apply for this program, but if you go to annadavidcoaching.com, you can get all the information about that. Maybe you too want to discover that you should be writing about your darkest moments. And
you're going to be inspiring somebody else.
Even
that
though they may not
sober.
Tell you,
they
only
won't tell you.
2 out of 2,000 will tell you.
You will help them.
You will know. Okay, so we will see you next time. Thank you.
Thank you.